Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 170th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. I'm FNH. Today we're starting off with the first part of an adventure set in the run-up to the 1418 War, and then we'll have a musical number from 1929, and then on to part 6 of our classic tale of horror. So today's opening story is a tale set in the run-up to World War I. It's a well-known title, and it's called The 39 Steps. Let's get started. Chapter 1. The Man Who Died. I returned from the city about 3 o'clock on that May afternoon, pretty well disgusted with life. I'd been 3 months in the old country, and was fed up with it. If anyone had told me a year ago that I would be feeling like that, I should have laughed at him. But there was the fact. The weather made me liverish. The talk of ordinary Englishmen made me sick. I couldn't get enough exercise, and the amusements of London seemed as flat as soda water that's been left standing in the sun. Richard Hannay, I kept telling myself, you've got into the wrong ditch, my friend, and you had better climb out. It made me bite my lips to think of the plans I'd been building up those last years in Bulawayo. I had got my pile, not one of the big ones, but good enough for me, and I had figured out all kinds of the ways of enjoying myself. My father had brought me out from Scotland at the age of 6, and I'd never been home since. So England was a sort of Arabian Nights to me, and I counted on stopping there for the rest of my days. But from the first, I was disappointed with it. In about a week, I was tired of seeing sights, and in less than a month, I'd had enough of restaurants and theatres and race meetings. I had no real pal to go about with, which probably explains things. Plenty of people invited me to their houses, but they didn't seem much interested in me. They would fling me a question or two about South Africa, and then get on with their own affairs. A lot of imperialist ladies asked me to tea to meet schoolmasters from New Zealand and editors from Vancouver, and that was the dismalest business of all. Here was I, 37 years old, sound in wind and limb, with enough money to have a good time, yawning my head off all day. I had just about settled to clear out and get back to the Veld, for I was the best bored man in the United Kingdom. That afternoon, I had been worrying my brokers about investments to give my mind something to work on, and on my way home I turned into my club, rather a pothouse, which took in colonial members. I had a long drink and read the evening papers. They were full of the row in the northeast, and there was an article about Karolides, the Greek premier. I rather fancied the chap. From all accounts, he seemed the one big man in the show, and he played a straight game too, which was more than could be said for most of them. I gathered that they hated him pretty blackly in Berlin and Vienna, but that we were going to stick by him. And one paper said that he was the only barrier between Europe and Armageddon. I remember wondering if I could get a job in those parts. It struck me that Albania was the sort of place that might keep a man from yawning. About 6 o'clock I went home, dressed, dined at the Café Royal, and turned into a music hall. It was a silly show, all capering women and monkey-faced men, and I did not stay long. The night was fine and clear as I walked back to the flat I had hired near Portland Place. The crowd surged past me on the pavements, busy and chattering, and I envied the people for having something to do. These shop girls and clerks and dandies and policemen had some interest in life that kept them going. I gave 0.5 crown to a beggar because I saw him yawn. He was a fellow sufferer. At Oxford Circus, I looked up into the spring sky, and I made a vow. I would give the old country another day to fit me into something. If nothing happened, I would take the next boat for the Cape. My flat was the first floor in a new block behind Langham Place. There was a common staircase with a porter and a liftman at the entrance, but there was no restaurant or anything of that sort, and each flat was quite shut off from the others. I hate servants on the premises, so I had a fellow to look after me who came in by the day. He arrived before 8 o'clock every morning and used to depart at 7, for I never dined at home. I was just fitting my key into the door when I noticed a man at my elbow. I'd not seen him approach, and the sudden appearance made me start. He was a slim man with a short brown beard and small gimlety blue eyes. I recognised him as the occupant of the flat on the top floor, with whom I had passed the time of day on the stairs. "Can I speak to you?" he said. "May I come in for a minute?" He was steadying his voice with an effort, and his hand was pawing at my arm. I got my door open and motioned him in. No sooner was he over the threshold than he made a dash for my back room, where I used to smoke and write my letters, and then he bolted back. "Is the door locked?" he asked feverishly, and he fastened the chain with his own hand. "I'm very sorry," he said humbly. "It's a mighty liberty, but you looked the kind of man who would understand. I've had you in my mind all this week when things got troublesome. Say, will you do me a good turn?" "I'll listen to you," I said. "That's all I'll promise." I was getting worried by the antics of this nervous little chap. There was a tray of drinks on the table beside him, from which he filled himself a stiff whiskey and soda. He drank it off in 3 gulps and cracked the glass as he set it down. "Pardon," he said, "I'm a bit rattled tonight. You see, I happen at this moment to be dead." I sat down in an armchair and lit my pipe. "What does it feel like?" I asked. I was pretty certain that I had to deal with a madman. A smile flickered over his drawn face. "I'm not mad, yet. Say, sir, I've been watching you and I reckon you're a cool customer. I reckon, too, you're an honest man and not afraid of playing a bold hand. I'm going to confide in you. I need help worse than any man ever needed it, and I want to know if I can count on you." "Get on with your yarn," I said, "and I'll tell you." He seemed to brace himself for a great effort, and then started on the queerest rigmarole. I didn't get hold of it at first, and I had to stop and ask him questions, but here is the gist of it. He was an American from Kentucky, and after college, being pretty well off, he had started out to see the world. He wrote a bit and acted as war correspondent for a Chicago paper, and spent a year or two in southeastern Europe. I gathered that he was a fine linguist and had got to know pretty well the society in those parts. He spoke familiarly of many names that I remembered to have seen in the newspapers. He had played about with politics, he told me, at first for the interest of them, and then because he couldn't help himself. I read him as a sharp, restless fellow, who always wanted to get down to the roots of things. He got a little further down than he wanted. I'm giving you what he told me as well as I could make it out. Away behind all the governments and the armies, there was a big subterranean movement going on, engineered by a very dangerous people. He had come on it by accident, and it fascinated him. He went further, and then he got caught. I gathered that most of the people in it were the sort of educated anarchists that make up revolutions, but that beside them there were financiers who were playing for money. A clever man can make big profits on a falling market, and it suited the book of both classes to set Europe by the ears. He told me some queer things that explained a lot that had puzzled me, things that happened in the Balkan War, how one state suddenly came out on top, why alliances were made and broken, why certain men disappeared, and where the sinews of war came from. The aim of the whole conspiracy was to get Russia and Germany at loggerheads. When I asked why, he said that the anarchist lot thought it would give them their chance. Everything would be in the melting pot, and they looked to see a new world emerge. The capitalists would rake in the shekels and make fortunes by buying up wreckage. Capital, he said, had no conscience and no fatherland. Besides, the Jew was behind it, and the Jew hated Russia worse than hell. Do you wonder? He cried. For 300 years they've been persecuted, and this is the return match for the pogroms. The Jew is everywhere, but you have to go far down the back stairs to find him. Take any big Teutonic business concern, if you have any dealings with it. The first man you meet is a prince, von Unzu something, an elegant man who talks Eton and Harrow English. But he cuts no ice. If your business is big, you get behind him and find a Prothaginus Westphalian with a retreating brow and the manners of a hog. He is the German businessman that gives the English papers the shakes. But if you're on the biggest kind of job, and you're bound to get the real boss, 10 to 1, you're brought up against a little white-faced Jew in the bath chair with an eye like a rattlesnake. Yes, sir, he's the man who is ruling the world just now, and he has his knife in the empire of the Tsar, because his aunt was outraged and his father flogged in some one-horse location on the Volga. I cannot help saying that his Jew anarchists seem to have got left behind a little. Yes and no, he said. They won up to a point. But they struck a bigger thing than money, a thing that couldn't be bought, the old elemental fighting instincts of man. If you're going to be killed, you invent some kind of flag and country to fight for. And if you survive, you get to love that thing. Those foolish devils of soldiers have found something they care for, and that has upset the pretty plan laid in Berlin and Vienna. But my friends haven't played their last card by a long sight. They've gotten the ace up their sleeves, and unless I can keep alive for a month, they're going to play it and win. But I thought you were dead, I put in. Mors Diana Vitae, he smiled. I recognised the quotation. It was all the Latin I knew. I'm coming to that. But I've got to put you wise about a lot of things first. If you read your newspaper, I guess you know the name of Constantine Karolides. I sat up at that, for I'd been reading about him that very afternoon. He is the man that has wrecked all their games. He is the one big brain in the whole show. And he also happens to be an honest man. Therefore, he has been marked down these 12 months past. I found that out, not that it was difficult, for any fool could guess as much. But I found out the way they were going to get him, and that knowledge was deadly. That's why I had to decease. He had another drink, and I mixed it for him myself, for I was getting interested in the beggar. They can't get him in his own land, for he has a bodyguard of Aperiotes, and they would skin their grandmothers. But on the 15th day of June, he's coming to this city. The British Foreign Office has taken to having international tea parties, and the biggest of them is due on that date. Now Karolides is reckoned the principal guest, and if my friends have their way, he will never return to his admiring countrymen. That's simple enough anyhow, I said. You can warn him and keep him at home. And play their game, he asked sharply. If he does not come, they win, for he's the only man that can straighten out the tangle. And if his government are warned, he won't come, for he does not know how big the stakes will be on June the 15th. What about the British government? I said. They're not going to let their guests be murdered. Tip them the wink, and they'll take extra precautions. No good. They might stuff your city with plainclothes detectives and double the police, and Constantine would still be a doomed man. My friends are not playing this game for candy. They want a big occasion for taking off with the eyes of all Europe on it. He'll be murdered by an Austrian, and there'll be plenty of evidence to show the connivance of the big folk in Vienna and Berlin. It will all be an infernal lie, of course, but the case will look black enough to the world. I'm not talking hot air, my friend. I happen to know every detail of the hellish contrivance, and I can tell you, it will be the most finished piece of blackguardism since the Borgias. But it's not going to come off if there's a certain man who knows the wheels of the business alive right here in London on the 15th day of June. And that man is going to be your servant, Franklin P. Scudder. I was getting to like the little chap. His jaw had shut like a rat trap, and there was the fire of battle in his gimlety eyes. If he was spinning me a yarn, he could act up to it. Where did you find out this story? I asked. I got the first hint in an inn on the Ascensi in Tyrol. That set me inquiring, and I collected my other clues in a fur shop in the Galician quarter of Buda, in a strangers' club in Vienna, and in a little bookshop off the Rack-Nitzstrasse in Leipzig. I completed my evidence 10 days ago in Paris. I can't tell you the details now, for it's something of a history. When I was quite sure of my own mind, I judged it my business to disappear, and I reached this city by a mighty queer circuit. I left Paris a dandified young French-American, and I sailed from Hamburg a Jew diamond merchant. In Norway, I was an English student of Isbon, collecting materials for lectures. But when I left Bergen, I was a cinema man with a special ski film. And I came here from Leith with a lot of pulpwood propositions in my pocket to put before the London newspapers. Till yesterday, I had thought I had muddied my trail some, and was feeling pretty happy. Then the recollection seemed to upset him, and he gulped down some more whiskey. Then I saw a man standing in the street outside this block. I used to stay close in my room all day and slip out after dark for an hour or two. I watched him for a bit from my window, and I thought I recognised him. He came in and spoke to the porter. When I came back from my walk last night, I found a card in my letterbox. It bore the name of the man I want least to meet on God's earth. I think that the look in my companion's eyes and sheer naked scare on his face completed my conviction of his honesty. My own voice sharpened a bit, and I asked him what he did next. I realised that I was bottled as sure as a pickled herring, and that there was only one way out. I had to die. If my pursuers knew I was dead, they would go to sleep again. How did you manage it? I told the man that valets me that I was feeling pretty bad, and I got myself up to look like death. That wasn't difficult, for I'm no slouch at disguises. And then I got a corpse. You can always get a body in London if you know where to go for it. I fetched it back in a trunk on the top of a four-wheeler, and I had to be assisted upstairs to my room. You see, I had to pile up some evidence for the inquest. I went to bed and got my man to mix me a sleeping draught, and then told him to clear out. He wanted to fetch a doctor, but I swore some and said I couldn't abide leeches. When I was left alone, I started in to fake up that corpse. He was my size, and I judged had perished from too much alcohol. So I put some spirits handy about the place. The jaw was the weak point in the likeness, so I blew it away with a revolver. I dare say there will be somebody tomorrow to swear to having heard a shot, but there are no neighbours on my floor, and I guessed I could risk it. So I left the body in the bed, dressed up in my pyjamas, with a revolver lying on the bedclothes and a considerable mess around. Then I got into a suit of clothes I'd kept waiting for emergencies. I didn't dare to shave for fear of leaving tracks, and besides, it wasn't any kind of use my trying to get into the streets. I had you in my mind all day, and there seemed nothing to do but to make an appeal to you. I watched from my window till I saw you come home, and then slipped down the stair to meet you. There, sir. I guess you know about as much of this business as I do. He sat blinking, like an owl, fluttering with nerves and yet desperately determined. By this time I was pretty well convinced that he was going straight with me. It was the wildest sort of narrative, but I'd heard in my time many steep tales which had turned out to be true, and I'd made a practice of judging the man rather than the story. If he had wanted to get a location in my flat, and then cut my throat, he could have pitched a milder yarn. "Hand me your key," I said, "and I'll take a look at the corpse. Excuse my caution, but I'm bound to verify a bit if I can." He shook his head mournfully. "I reckoned you'd ask for that, but I haven't got it. It's on my chain on the dressing table. I had to leave it behind, for I couldn't leave any clues to breed suspicions. The gentry who are after me are pretty bright-eyed citizens. You'll have to take me on trust for the night, and tomorrow you'll get proof of the corpse business right enough." I thought for an instant or two. "Right. I'll trust you for the night. I'll lock you into this room and keep the key. Just one word, Mr. Scudder. I believe you're straight. but if so be you are not, I should warn you that I am a handy man with a gun. Sure, he said, jumping up with some briskness. I haven't the privilege of your name, sir, but let me tell you that you're a white man, and I'll thank you to lend me a razor. I took him into my bedroom and turned him loose. In half an hour's time, a figure came out that I scarcely recognised. Only his gimlety, hungry eyes were the same. He'd shaved clean. His hair was parted in the middle, and he had cut his eyebrows. Further, he'd carried himself as if he had been drilled, and was the very model, even to the brown complexion, of some British officer who had had a long spell in India. He had a monocle, too, which he stuck in his eye, and every trace of the American had gone out of his speech. "My hat, Mr. Scudder!" I stammered. "Not Mr. Scudder," he corrected. "Captain Theophilus Digby of the 40th Gurkhas, presently home on leave. I thank you to remember that, sir." I made him up a bed in my smoking room, and sought my own couch, more cheerful than I had been for the past month. Things did happen occasionally, even in this God-forgotten metropolis. I woke the next morning to hear my man, Paddock, making the deuce of a row at the smoking room door. Paddock was a fellow I'd done a good turn to out on the Salaquir, and I'd inspanned him as my servant as soon as I got to England. He had about as much gift for the gab as a hippopotamus, and was not a great hand at valeting, but I knew I could count on his loyalty. "Stop that row, Paddock," I said. "There's a friend of mine, Captain, I couldn't remember the name, dossing down in there. Get breakfast for two, and then come back and speak to me." I told Paddock a fine story about how my friend was a great swell with his nerves pretty bad from overwork, who wanted absolute rest and stillness. Nobody had got to know he was here, or he would be besieged by communications from the India Office and the Prime Minister, and his cure would be ruined. I am bound to say Scudder played up splendidly when he came to breakfast. He fixed Paddock with his eyeglass just like a British officer, asked him about the Boer War, and slung out a lot of stuff about imaginary pals. Paddock couldn't learn to call me sir, but he sirred Scudder as if his life depended on it. I left him with the newspaper and a box of cigars, and went down to the city till luncheon. When I got back, the lift man had an important face. "Nasty business here this morning, sir. Gent in number 15 had been shot hisself. They just took him to the mortuary. The police are up there now." I ascended to number 15, and found a couple of bobbies and an inspector making busy examination. I asked a few idiotic questions, and they soon kicked me out. Then I found the man that had valeted Scudder, and pumped him, but I could see he suspected nothing. He was a whining fellow with a churchyard face, and half a crown went far to console him. I attended the inquest the next day. A partner of some publishing firm gave evidence that the deceased had brought in wood pulp propositions and had been, he believed, an agent of an American business. The jury found it a case of suicide while of unsound mind, and the few effects were handed over to the American consul to deal with. I gave Scudder a full account of the affair, and it interested him greatly. He said he wished he could have attended the inquest, for he reckoned it would be about as spicy as to read one's own obituary notice. The first 2 days he stayed with me in that back room, and he was very peaceful. He read and smoked a bit, and made a heap of jottings in a notebook. And every night we had a game of chess at which he beat me hollow. I think he was nursing his nerves back to health, for he had a pretty trying time. But on the third day, I could see he was beginning to get restless. He fixed up a list of the days till June the 15th, and ticked each off with a red pencil, making remarks in shorthand against them. I would find him sunk in a brown study with his eyes sharply abstracted, and after those spells of meditation, he was apt to be very despondent. Then I could see that he was beginning to get edgy again. He listened for little noises, and was always asking me if Paddock could be trusted. Once or twice he got very peevish and apologised for it. I didn't blame him. I made every allowance, for he had taken on a fairly stiff job. It was not the safety of his own skin that troubled him, but the success of the scheme he had planned. That little man was clean grit all through, without a soft spot in him. One night he was very solemn. "Say, Hannay," he said, "I judge I should let you a bit deeper into this business. I should hate to go out without leaving somebody else to put up a fight." And he began to tell me in detail what I had only heard from him vaguely. I did not give him very close attention. The fact is, I was more interested in his own adventures than in his high politics. I reckoned that Carolides and his affairs were not my business, leaving all that to him. So a lot of what he said slipped clean out of my memory. I remember that he was very clear that the danger to Carolides would not begin till he had got to London, and would come from the very highest quarters where there would be no thought of suspicion. He mentioned the name of a woman, Julia Cecchini, as having something to do with this danger. She would be the decoy, I gathered, to get Carolides out of the care of his guards. He talked too about a black stone and a man that lisped with his speech, and he described very particularly somebody that he never referred to without a shudder, an old man with a young voice who could hood his eyes like a hawk. He spoke a good deal about death too. He was mortally anxious about winning through with his job, but he didn't care a rush for his life. I reckon it's like going to sleep when you're pretty well tired out, and waking to find a summer day with the scent of hay coming in at the window. I used to thank God for such mornings way back in the bluegrass country, and I guess I'll thank him when I wake up on the other side of Jordan. Next day, he was much more cheerful, and read the life of Stonewall Jackson much of the time. I went out to dinner with a mining engineer I'd got to see on business, and came back about 10:30 in time for our game of chess before turning in. I had a cigar in my mouth, I remember, as I pushed open the smoking room door. The lights were not lit, which struck me as odd, and I wondered if Scudder had turned in already. I snapped the switch, but there was nobody there, and then I saw something in the far corner which made me drop my cigar and fall into a cold sweat. My guest was lying sprawled on his back, and there was a long knife through his heart which skewered him to the floor. There ends part one of a classic tale of adventure. But I thought I'd mention a few things that occurred to me while narrating this segment. First off, if you're a regular listener, you'll know that some of the texts I read are of the old world in outlook. This includes the blatant racism of Stanley and the slightly more hooded racism of Lovecraft. But in the opening of this story, there's the hint of anti-Semitism, and the uncomfortable feeling that gave me made me look into the story a little further. This story was published as a serial starting in 1915, while the war was still building up and the story is set in the run-up to that war. That's not the only coincidence. The correlation between the assassination of fictional Carolides and the act of the actual murder of Prince Ferdinand, both leading to the outbreak of war, cannot be a coincidence. Furthermore, Ferdinand was killed by a group labelled the Black Hand, and the evil organisation in this story are called the Black Stone. Obviously, the author Buchan was making some straightforward comparisons. Which leads me on to this anti-Jewish sentiments expressed by Scudder and apparently accepted by Hannay in our story. A little research has shown that low-grade anti-Semitism was rife in this time frame, and extreme right-wingers were banging the blame gong. So that may be why it appears here. I'm not going to apologise for the racism or the anti-Semitism in these works, because I'm just reading history and stories as told by others. But I will say this. If you, in all seriousness, judge a man by his race, his religion, or even his nation, and not by his word and his deed, then you, sir, are clearly a peewit. Judge a man for who he is. And, on a lighter note, today's music may be a favourite of Doctor Who. It's B.B. Daniel singing a track called River Song.
down by the river road. My dreams I've been happening there. I'm happening in the air, waiting for who knows who. I've been seeing on it the moon, lit dreams, and the best of all.
And so on to today's main feature, The Wendigo. Part 6. The sudden entrance of his prosaic uncle into this world of wizardry and horror that had haunted him without interruption now for 2 days and 2 nights had the immediate effect of giving the affair an entirely new aspect. The sound of that crisp, "Hello, my boy, what's up now?" and the grasp of that dry and vigorous hand introduced another standard of judgment. A revulsion of feeling washed through him. He realized he had let go of himself rather badly. He even felt vaguely ashamed of himself, and the native hard-headedness of his race reclaimed him. And this doubtless explains why he found it so hard to tell that group round the fire everything. He told enough, however, for the immediate decision to be arrived at that a relief party must start at the earliest possible moment, and that Simpson, in order to guide it capably, must first have food and, above all, sleep. Dr. Cathcart, observing the lad's condition more shrewdly than his patient knew, gave him a very slight injection of morphine. For 6 hours he slept, like the dead. From the description carefully written out afterwards by this student of divinity, it appears that the account he gave to the astonished group omitted sundry vital and important details. He declares that, with his uncle's wholesome matter-of-fact countenance starting him in the face, he simply had not the courage to mention them. Thus, all the search party gathered, it would seem, was that Defago had suffered in the night an acute and inexplicable attack of mania, had imagined himself called by someone or something, and had plunged into the bush after it, without food or rifle, where he must die a horrible and lingering death by cold and starvation, unless he could be found and rescued in time. In time, moreover, meant at once. In the course of the following day, however, they were off by 7, leaving Punk in charge with instructions to have food and fire always ready. Simpson found it possible to tell his uncle a good deal more of the story's true inwardness, without divining that it was drawn out of him as a matter of fact by a very subtle form of cross-examination. By the time they reached the beginning of the trail, where the canoe was laid up against the return journey, he had mentioned how Defago spoke vaguely of something he called a Wendigo, how he cried in his sleep, how he imagined an unusual scent about the camp, and had betrayed other symptoms of mental excitement. He also admitted the bewildering effect of that extraordinary odour upon himself, pungent and acrid like the odour of lions. And by the time they were within an easy hour of 50 Island Water, he had let slip the further fact, a foolish avowal of his own hysterical condition as he afterwards felt, that he had heard the vanished guide call for help. He omitted the singular phrases used, for he simply could not bring himself to repeat the preposterous language. Also, while describing how the man's footsteps in the snow had gradually assumed an exact miniature likeness of the animal's plunging tracks, He left out the fact that they measured a wholly incredible distance. It seemed a question nicely balanced between individual pride and honesty, what he should reveal and what suppress. He mentioned the fiery tinge in the snow, for instance, yet shrank from telling that body and bed had been partly dragged out of the tent. With the net result that Dr. Cathcart, adroit psychologist that he fancied himself to be, had assumed him clearly enough exactly where his mind, influenced by loneliness, bewilderment and terror, had yielded to the strain and invited delusion. While praising his conduct, he managed at the same time to point out where, when and how his mind had gone astray. He made his nephew think himself finer than he was by judicious praise, yet more foolish than he was by minimising the value of the evidence. Like many other a materialist, that is, he lied cleverly upon the basis of insufficient knowledge because the knowledge supplied seemed to his own particular intelligence inadmissible. "The spell of these terrible solitudes," he began, "cannot leave the mind untouched, any mind that is possessed by the higher imaginative qualities. It has worked upon yours exactly as it has worked upon my own when I was your age. The animal that haunted your little camp was undoubtedly a moose, for the belling of a moose may have sometimes a very peculiar quality of sound. The coloured appearance of the big tracks was obviously a defect of the vision of your own eyes, produced by excitement. The size and stretch of the tracks we shall prove when we come to them. But the hallucination of an audible voice, of course, is one of the commonest forms of delusion due to mental excitement. An excitement, my dear boy, perfectly excusable, and let me add, wonderfully controlled by you under the circumstances. For the rest, I am bound to say you have acted with a splendid courage, for the terror of feeling oneself lost in this wilderness is nothing short of awful, and had I been in your place, I don't for a moment believe I could have behaved with one quarter of your wisdom and decision. The only thing I find it uncommonly difficult to explain is that damned odour. It made me feel sick, I can assure you," declared his nephew, "positively dizzy." His uncle's attitude of calm omniscience, merely because he knew more psychological formulae, made him slightly defiant. It was so easy to be wise in the explanation of an experience one has not personally witnessed. "A kind of desolate and terrible odour is the only way I can describe it," he concluded, glancing at the features of the quiet, unemotional man beside him. "I can only marvel," was the reply, "that under the circumstances it did not seem to you even worse." The dry words, Simpson knew, hovered between the truth and his uncle's interpretation of the truth. And so, at last, they came to the little camp and found the tent still standing, the remains of the fire, and the piece of paper pinned to the stake beside it, untouched. The cache, poorly contrived by inexperienced hands, however, had been discovered and opened by muskrats, mink and squirrel. The matches lay scattered about the opening, but the food had been taken to the last crumb. "Well, fellas, he ain't here," exclaimed Hank loudly after his fashion, "and that's as certain as the coal supply down below. But where he's got to, by this time, is about as uncertain as trade in crowns and t'other place." The presence of a divinity student was no barrier to his language at such a time, though for the reader's sake it may be severely edited. "I propose," he added, "that we start out at once and hunt for him like hell." The gloom of Defago's probable fate oppressed the whole party with a sense of dreadful gravity the moment that they saw the familiar signs of recent occupancy. Especially the tent, with the bed of balsam branches still smoothed and flattened by the pressure of his body, it seemed to bring his presence near to them. Simpson, feeling vaguely as if his world were somehow at stake, went about explaining particulars in a hushed tone. He was much calmer now, though overwearied with the strain of his many journeys. His uncle's method of explaining away, the details still fresh in his haunted memory helped, too, to put ice upon his emotions. "And that's the direction he ran off in," he said to his two companions, pointing in the direction where the guide had vanished that morning in the grey dawn. "Straight down there he ran like a deer, in between the birch and the hemlock." Hank and Dr. Cathcart exchanged glances, and it was about 2 miles down there, in a straight line, continued the other, speaking with something of the former terror in his voice, that I followed his trail to the place where it stopped, dead. And where you heard him a-callin', and caught a stench and all the rest of the wicked entertainment, cried Hank, with a volubility that betrayed his keen distress. And where your excitement overcame you to the point of producing illusions, added Dr. Cathcart under his breath, yet not so low that his nephew did not hear it. It was early in the afternoon, for they had travelled quickly, and there was still a good 2 hours of daylight left. Dr. Cathcart and Hank lost no time in beginning the search, but Simpson was too exhausted to accompany them. They would follow the blazed marks on the trees, and where possible his footsteps. Meanwhile, the best thing he could do was to keep a good fire going, and to rest. But after something like 3 hours' search, the darkness already down, the two men returned to camp with nothing to report. Fresh snow had covered all signs, and though they had followed the blazed trees to the spot where Simpson had turned back, they had not discovered the smallest indication of a human being, or, for that matter, of an animal. There were no fresh tracks of any kind. The snow lay undisturbed. It was difficult to know what best to do, though in reality there was nothing more they could do. They might stay and search for weeks without much chance of success. The fresh snow destroyed their only hope, and they gathered round the fire for supper, a gloomy and despondent party. The facts, indeed, were sad enough, for Defago had a wife at Rat Portage, and his earnings were the family's sole means of support. Now that the whole truth of it, in its ugliness, was out, it seemed useless to deal in further disguise or pretense. They talked openly of the facts and probabilities. It was not the first time, even in the experience of Dr. Cathcart, that a man had yielded to the singular seduction of the solitudes and gone out of his mind. Defago, moreover, was predisposed to something of the sort, for he already had a touch of melancholia in his blood, and his fibre was weakened by bouts of drinking that often lasted for weeks at a time. Something on this trip, one might never know precisely what, had sufficed to push him over the line, and that was all. He had gone off into the great wilderness of trees and lakes to die by starvation and exhaustion. The chances against his finding camp again were overwhelming. The delirium that was upon him would also doubtless have increased, and it was quite likely that he might do violence to himself and so hasten his cruel fate. Even while they talked, indeed, the end had probably come. On the suggestion of Hank, his old pal, however, they proposed to wait a little longer and devote the whole of the following day, from dawn to darkness, to the most systematic search they could devise. They would divide the territory between them. They discussed their plan in great detail. All that men could do, they would do. And meanwhile, they talked about the particular form in which the singular panic of the wilderness had made its attack upon the mind of the unfortunate guide. Hank, though familiar with the legend in its general outline, obviously did not welcome the turn the conversation had taken. He contributed little, though that little was illuminating, for he admitted that a story ran all over this section of country to the effect that several Indians had seen the Wendigo along the shores of 50 Island Water in the fall of last year, and that this was the true reason of Defago's disinclination to hunt there. Hank doubtless felt that he had, in a sense, helped his old pal to death by over-persuading him. When an Indian goes crazy, he explained, talking to himself more than to the others, it's always put down that he's seen the Wendigo. A poor old Defago was superstitious down to his very heels. And then Simpson, feeling the atmosphere more sympathetic, told over again the full story of his astonishing tale. He left out no details this time. He mentioned his own sensations and gripping fears. He only omitted the strange language used. But Defago surely had already told you these details of the Wendigo legend, my dear fellow, insisted the doctor. I mean, he had talked about it, and thus put into your mind the ideas which your own excitement afterwards developed. whereupon Simpson again repeated the facts. Defago, he declared, had barely mentioned the beast. He, Simpson, knew nothing of the story, and so far as he remembered, had never even read about it. Even the word was unfamiliar. Of course, he was telling the truth, and Dr. Cathcart was reluctantly compelled to admit the singular character of the whole affair. He did not do this in words so much as in manner. He kept his back against a good stout tree. He poked the fire into a blaze the moment it showed signs of dying down. He was quicker than any of them to notice the least sound in the night about them. A fish jumping in the lake, a twig snapping in the bush, the dropping of occasional fragments of frozen snow from the branches overhead where the heat loosened them. His voice, too, changed a little in quality, becoming a shade less confident, lower also in tone. Fear, to put it plainly, hovered close about that little camp, and though all three would have been glad to speak of other matters, the only thing they seemed able to discuss was this, the source of their very fear. They tried other subjects in vain. There was nothing to say about them. Hank was the most honest of the group. He said next to nothing. He never once, however, turned his back to the darkness. His face was always to the forest, and when wood was needed, he didn't go further than was necessary to get it. Well, that's it for today. Opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project, as usual, and this file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk